Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
This program is supported by great listeners, and we like to name names. Robert Donjacour, James Bulk, Michael Macmillan, and all the way from Costa Rica, Larry Doers. They are voluntary subscribers to the PBC show. If you'd like to be like them and you can afford it, go to my website, peterbcollins.com. The links on the right-hand page allow you to subscribe voluntarily for $5 a month or more. Later in this podcast today, we're going to meet an angry American who's about to be laid off from a job that he's held for 26 years. And he's written a song based on his anger. It's called My Country, My Ass. And we have the uncensored version we'll play for you at the beginning of that conversation. But first, we get the lowdown on President Obama's spin regarding troop levels in Afghanistan. Obama spins on the Afghanistan war. Remember this song that Fogerty did about George W. Bush?
I can't take it no more. I can't take it no more. I'm sick and tired of the dirty little war. I can't take it no more.
Most Americans feel that way.
You know you lied about the casualties. You know you lied about the WFD. You know
the American people want out of Afghanistan by significant numbers. It dipped a little bit after the killing of Osama bin Laden, but it has spiked back up. And it is bipartisan. Members of both parties are very tired of the war in Afghanistan. The cost is starting to register, particularly with those who are working to cut the deficit. And so last week, the president gave a speech. Gareth Porter joins us to talk about the presidential spin on Afghanistan. He is an investigative historian and journalist specializing in U.S. national security policy. Gareth, thanks for joining us again today.
Hey, thanks for having me again, Peter.
And the president gave a 15-minute speech. It was timed just before the 1st of July, as he had promised, on December 1st of 2009. When he gave the speech at West Point, talking about his so-called surge of an additional 33,000 troops into Afghanistan. And when you unspin the president's remarks and the timelines, what we show is that at about November of 2012, when the president stands for re-election, we're going to have somewhere north of 50,000 troops in Afghanistan, certainly more than were there when the president took office. And so this to me is a very disturbing trend. Give me your first thoughts about the challenge the president faced in trying to honor his commitment to his political base of liberals and progressives while maintaining consistency and continuing to essentially take the orders of General Petraeus and the other military leaders in his inner circle.
Well, I think, you know, effectively what this conflict that you're referring to amounted to was a conflict between the Petraeus military Pentagon interests on one hand, which was to continue to have enough troops, well, not just enough troops, but to have the full complement of troops with perhaps a very small reduction from that, that was sent by called the surge in 2010. For two full more years of fighting, two full seasons of fighting, as they call it. That was the interest that Petraeus and his people had. But on the other side, within the administration itself, you had Vice President Biden and a group of officials who had been skeptical about the commitment to counterinsurgency war, full-scale counterinsurgency war in Afghanistan in the first place, and who have been calling for a much faster withdrawal. They wanted all of the surge forces of 33,000 to be pulled out this year,
right,
before the end of the year, and then a continuation of the pullout after that, continue a good pace of withdrawal even beyond 2011. So that you'd get down to, you know, 25, 30, 40,000 troops pretty fast. So what we see President Obama doing here is essentially splitting the difference in a way. I mean, you know, in terms of the calendar, he split the difference between what the Biden faction, if you will, what I call a domestic faction of his administration, because they were so concerned about the cost of the war as the primary issue. He's, you know, they wanted everybody from the surge complement out by the end of this year, whereas Petraeus wanted them to be there for another two full years of fighting. So he basically split the difference and said, well, they'll the surge troops, 33,000, will all be out by September of 2013.
And Gareth, I mean, one of the things here that seems to be quite...
Excuse me, 2012. I'm sorry. I said 2013. I meant 2012.
Yes, I got you there. What seems to be a game that is being played here is the idea that the Taliban and the others who are fighting against us in Afghanistan and in parts of Pakistan, that they are going to respond affirmatively to both the stated desire for us to draw down our troops over the next year and a half, and to this threat that we will keep troops in Afghanistan in significant numbers, like 50,000, into 2014 and beyond. So we have very mixed messages, and they don't serve anyone's interests, because on the one hand, the hardliners say we can't tip off the enemy about when we plan to leave, because that will harden their resolve and they will just wait us out. Yet we've already announced that intention. And so we can't have this you know, dual game going on where we're trying to pacify the interests of the American people who clearly resist this continued occupation, at the same time that we're trying to pretend to those in Afghanistan that they ought to be really, really scared because we're going to be there for an indefinite period of time.
Well, I totally agree with you. I think that's absolutely correct, that there's an inherent contradiction here between the very fundamental notion of the military strategy, which is, well, we've got to, you know, make people believe that we're going to stay around for a while, and the obvious reality that that cannot possibly happen. The United States is going to have to get its troops out, whether it's 2013, 2012, or 2014. There's simply no way to maintain a large troop presence in Afghanistan for a long period of time. And that means, you're absolutely right, that means that the Taliban know perfectly well that the United States and even, you know, equally important, the NATO troops, who, you know, they are now 50,000 NATO troops there in Afghanistan, they're getting out. They're making it clear. All the NATO countries have announced in the past week that they have an accelerated schedule of withdrawal now. So the Taliban know that, you know, when the smoke clears, within a very few years, whether it's 2013, 2014, the United States is at best going to have a small residual force there. I mean, we're talking about leaving special operations forces there to continue to carry out these night raids. I think that that's foolishness. I don't think that it's realistic to believe that you can maintain a few thousand, you know, 10, 15,000 special operations forces troops there without the protection of 100 to 150,000 Western troops. I think that's moonshine. But nevertheless, that is the contradiction that is inherent in the present policy.
And Gareth, I'm struggling here to try to peel back kind of the layers of bullshit, if you'll excuse the expression.
I think that's perfectly justified, believe me.
So, I mean, on the one hand, we continue to present this ideal that just given enough time, you know, Tom Friedman's six more months,
two more
fighting seasons, that we're going to be able to achieve what is clearly unachievable. And so the real thing that we have to swallow here is our sense of American exceptionalism, that we are exceptional and can do what the Soviets and the British and those before them could not do. And, you know, Obama talked in his speech last week about how, you know, we're just waiting for the Afghans to get up to speed so that they can take over their own security. Well, that is bullshit. They will never have a central government with the kind of credibility and authority to take on the warlords that control various hinterlands of Afghanistan. And the Tajik-Pashtun rivalries will continue to drive the problems of governance in that country. So we've got to peel back the myth-making here. First, that somehow we can prevail where others haven't. And secondly, that there is anybody to hand off to when we presumably reach some magic point where we say, okay, now American troops can come home.
And of course, as you well know, I mean, that reality is something that was well known, was well understood in the White House and in the U.S. Embassy in Kabul in 2009 when President Obama was making the decision to put the 33,000 troops into that country. So there's nothing completely new. There's nothing new about that insight. What you have is a set of decisions which were made in 2009, 2010, despite the realization that we don't have a partner who has the popular support, who has legitimacy in Afghanistan, that the United States is not going to be able to achieve having an Afghan army that can adequately take on security responsibilities. I think all of those realities were well understood, but the momentum behind the military's determination to fight in Afghanistan was such that those realities simply had to be set aside. And so now I think what is happening is that on top of this set of, I think, very well understood constraints on the possibility of success in Afghanistan, you have a military leadership in Afghanistan under General David Petraeus, which is desperately trying to maintain morale there in a situation where that morale is at best very shaky. And I just spoke with someone today who is in Afghanistan in the U.S. military who tells me that we have a serious problem now, that the people in the intelligence component of the command in Kabul, in the U.S. NATO command, are basically being forbidden from telling the truth about the situation. When they have reported news that is unfavorable to the claim that we are succeeding, they have been chastised, and clearly the message has been conveyed to intelligence analysts that the bad news is not welcome. And so I think you have a bubble there in the U.S. command in Kabul, in the ISAF, the International Security Assistance Force Command that Petraeus presides over. You have a bubble that is continuing to maintain a kind of a false sense of success that appears to be necessary to avoid just a complete collapse of the effort.
And Gareth Porter, it's not going to improve because the guy who was running the drone strikes into Pakistan as head of the CIA, Leon Panetta, is being transferred to the Pentagon. And David Petraeus is now going to get the joystick over at the CIA to run the so-called secret wars in Pakistan, in Yemen, and we know that we're participating in Libya. There certainly may be other actions that are not known to the American public. But by maintaining this same very tight inner circle of people who really were a party to the Gates transition and Gates' whole mentality as a Bush acolyte, a former CIA guy, I mean, it's insider after insider. And this was the president who promised us an open and robust debate among a cabinet of rivals. And for Joe Biden to be out there on the left extreme...
This is very disconcerting, I agree. And I'm glad that you've raised this problem, which it is a serious problem, of the new post-Gates security team of the Obama administration, consisting of Panetta at defense, moving from the CIA to defense, and Petraeus moving from being the field commander to the head of the CIA. I can't imagine a worse combination, really, in terms of telling the truth about the situation, you know, not just in Afghanistan, but elsewhere in Pakistan and elsewhere where the United States is carrying out covert or semi-covert warfare, and in terms of really giving good advice to the White House about what needs to be done. I mean, this is a formula for carrying, you know, carrying forward the status quo, continuing the wars for as long as possible with as much money as possible, as much as these officials can possibly wring out of the system, because of the vested interest that both Petraeus and Panetta have from their previous posts. Clearly, they are people who are going to be pushing for a continuation of the kind of special operations forces and drone strike wars that the United States is now engaged in. And these are very questionable, to say the least, endeavors. These are endeavors that have a serious downside in terms of really alienating populations in Pakistan, Afghanistan, and elsewhere where the United States is doing this, Somalia, Yemen. And at the same time, these officials are essentially motivated to hide the downside in their reporting, their advice to the president. So, I mean, this is a formula which I think is very costly to the interests of the United States.
And I want to pause for a moment here just to comment on Leon Panetta. He's a man who I got to know as a congressman, as the budget chair of the House, as a deficit hawk in the early 1990s. And he was a man who showed, I thought, a great capability to work as an insider, but to challenge the status quo and to try to, you know, move toward reform. Those were budget reforms at the time. Then he went on to become Clinton's chief of staff in the Lewinsky White House and became part of that whole scandal. And he wasn't tarnished by it, but he certainly did some of the damage control. And to me, the most troubling aspect was when Senator Kit Bond raked him over the coals at Panetta's confirmation hearing for CIA director, because Panetta had acknowledged that we had tortured people under Bush, right, and took exception to that. And he backpedaled so frickin' fast when Kit Bond got in his face that it just was a really telling moment for me. And when you compare that with the accolades that he got and the 100 Senate votes for confirmation as Secretary of Defense, well, you know what that tells me? He's a made man now in the national security mafia.
I agree with you. I think that this is a very serious problem, that somebody who one would have hoped, coming from his background with concerns about domestic policy, obviously, as well as the budgetary issues, that he would have exercised a degree of critical thinking on issues of going to war, rather than sort of buying into the system, as it is apparent that he has actually done. I think it's really quite sad that Leon Panetta became essentially a pimp for the for the operations directorate of the CIA in terms of their interest in not just continuing but expanding the drone war in Pakistan in particular.
And Gareth, when he was first appointed, I was thrilled. I thought, wow, this is, you know, a fresh thinker, a guy who hasn't been in the Beltway the last few years. And while he was on the Iraq study group team that essentially propelled Gates in to replace Donald Rumsfeld, I really felt that here was a guy with heavy experience, but outside of the defense and intelligence communities.
Right.
And I didn't expect a huge shakeup, but just as you pointed out, I thought that he would be more balanced and try to rein in some of the cowboy activities of the ops teams, the people who conduct the covert operations, while trying to buttress both the role and the priorities delivered by the intelligence analysts, which was the original purpose of the CIA and the only part that I can really support.
Right, and I think what this tells us, what this shows, is that the Obama administration really has represented the apotheosis of the national security state in the sense that the national security apparatus, the institutions of national security, including particularly the CIA's Directorate of Operations, as well as the Pentagon and the military services, have achieved the greatest degree of power that they've ever had in terms of the control, the influence over policy. And you have a situation where somebody who should have, as we've just been saying, should have had a more independent view and policy orientation, has in fact completely bought into the national security state's interests. And now you have, of course, the choice of David Petraeus to replace him at the CIA, and that can only mean one thing, which is that there will be even more emphasis on the interests of the Directorate of Operations, and it's basically carrying out covert or semi-covert warfare. And that can only be a very bad sign in terms of the CIA's original purpose, which is to provide the best sort of analysis and information to policymakers that can be had. Because inevitably, as the power of the operations directorate rises, I think that it can only have a negative impact on the ability of the analytical side of the CIA to maintain its independence and provide quality intelligence.
And Gareth, if you can put your historian hat on here for a moment, last week I put out a podcast with Annie Jacobson, the LA Times reporter, who's written a fabulous new book about Area 51.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interesting aspects that she addresses there is rivalries between the Air Force and the CIA in developing first the U-2 spy planes, then the stealth bombers and stealth fighters, and more recently, although the classified curtain is still down on the role that Area 51 may have played in the development of drones, it's widely believed that that is where that all started, very close, just 25 miles from the Creech Air Force Base outside Las Vegas, which is a drone control point that we know about. And so I wanted to get your thoughts, because often in recent weeks, the media has celebrated the execution of Osama bin Laden as the confluence of the CIA and military operations. But it really appears it was a CIA-only operation, and that this really is Leon Panetta's ticket to the unanimous confirmation as the new head of the Pentagon. But what is your thought about today's the status right now of those ongoing rivalries between the intelligence community and their military counterparts, and how this plays out with this leadership shuffle?
Well, my impression, for what it's worth, is that during the Obama administration, the real rivalry, the primary rivalry here, has been rivalry over operations, covert, semi-covert operations. And that has really been between the CIA's operations directorate on one hand and the special operations forces on the other, because they both are in the business of, you know, sort of these covert, semi-covert operations, and they both want to have a wider role in Pakistan, in Yemen, in Somalia, and particularly in Yemen. I've written about this. There has been a almost public rivalry between these two institutions, the Operations Directorate and the Special Operations Forces, to get control over the drone war in Yemen. Whereas the Special Operations Forces originally seemed to be getting the franchise, if you will, to operate in Yemen, the CIA was sort of leaking critical remarks about the SOF role there, which were to some extent justified by the fact that they screwed up the first effort, not a drone strike, but a missile, cruise missile strike in Yemen, went awry and killed innocent people. And the CIA tried to take advantage of that to suggest that, well, maybe SOF is not really up to this. Let's have this returned to the CIA. So, I mean, that's the best case that I know of the rivalry between those two outfits that I think is below the surface, more generally applicable to the sort of covert wars that are being carried out by the United States throughout the Middle East and beyond.
And Gareth, with respect to Yemen, I am deeply uncomfortable that we have targeted an American citizen for summary execution from the sky using these unmanned aerial drones. The man is Anwar al-Awlaki, who is an American citizen living in Yemen. He is an imam who has at least some very vitriolic statements are attributed to him. He has been linked, at least in media reports, to Hassan, the guy who shot up Fort Hood, Texas,
right,
and to Abdul Muttalib, the so-called underwear bomber who failed in his mission to blow up a jetliner coming into Detroit. Those are issues where he's been tried in a Nancy Grace manner. There has been no charge formally leveled against al-Awlaki. He has not been tried in absentia. And yet Americans seem very comfortable on this slippery slope that, hey, nobody charged or tried Osama bin Laden for 9/11. He had been charged with the coal attacks and with the embassy attacks in North Africa, but never tried, even in a kangaroo court at Guantanamo. And my question with this lengthy windup here is, are you finding any people in the intelligence community who have any discomfort with the idea of executing an American citizen in a foreign country?
I honestly cannot tell you that I have spoken with people, you know, in the intelligence community about this.
Okay.
All I can say is that, you know, there are plenty of people, I know for a fact, but there are plenty of people, you know, in the intelligence community that have questioned the whole notion of the drone campaign in Pakistan as something that is helpful to the war against terrorism. That there are people who believe that this is in fact having exactly the opposite effect. And I, you know, having really tried to study very carefully, very closely, the basis on which targeting has been carried out in Pakistan, as well as the Special Operations Forces targeting in Afghanistan, I am absolutely convinced that neither of these campaigns is based on really solid intelligence. I think that, you know, there is, you know, obviously they do have some accurate intelligence, but I think it's embedded in a much larger universe of tips and hunches and assumptions that very often turn out to be quite false. You know, who knows exactly what the percentage of false leads or false targeting is, but I can, I think, safely say, I say with great confidence that it is a very high percentage of the total targets in Pakistan and in Afghanistan that have been inaccurate. The wrong place at the wrong time, the wrong person targeted, somebody targeted who was the victim of a personal vendetta, a tribal vendetta, or what have you. All of these things are, I think, very serious reasons for opposing not just targeting American citizens. Obviously, an American citizen should not be targeted without the most, absolutely impeccable intelligence and a process that makes sure that this is really necessary.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even beyond that, the targeting of thousands of people over the past few years, a high percentage of which clearly have not been Al-Qaeda leaders or Al-Qaeda decision makers, but rather rank and file or even innocent civilians. This is just an outrageous and a terrible idea for the American people's interests. I mean, it is simply putting us at worse in a worse situation regarding the attitudes of Islamic people throughout the Middle East.
And Gareth, it's clear that we can't trust the Pakistanis, and in particular their intelligence service, the ISI. And yet we do rely on their tips for the targets that we select and attack in Pakistan.
That's an interesting question. I mean, it would appear that we must be reliant on them to some extent, but I have also seen some evidence that the United States has endeavored to free itself as completely as possible from the ISI in the targeting, and that they have, in fact, adopted their own system quite apart from the ISI. And, of course, this is clear from the fact that the United States has begun to target primarily, if not exclusively, Afghan Taliban and Pakistani Taliban targets who are primarily who are involved in the war against American troops in Afghanistan, not against the Pakistani government. Now, this is, of course, the fundamental divide between ISI and the Pakistani military on one hand and the U.S. military on the other. They do agree, well, there's no question about this, that the Pakistani military wants to target Al-Qaeda leaders and Pakistani Taliban leaders who have been basically calling for an uprising against the Pakistani military. But the difference is that the Pakistani military does not want to target Afghan Taliban or Pakistani Taliban who have been opposed to the hardline people in Pakistan who have carried out violence against the government. So, I mean, this is a fundamental conflict between mm-hmm. the Pakistani military's interests and the interests of the U.S. military. This is a very dangerous situation because of that conflict.
Well, I appreciate that. You've added to my knowledge, and I certainly defer to your greater contacts there. But doesn't that then presume that we have so-called boots on the ground on Pakistani territory? Because if we are able to target people without the support of the ISI, where's that info coming from?
Well, I think it comes from essentially buying off Afghan and Pashtun, Pakistani Pashtun, individuals who do the spotting for them for money, they obviously provide some accurate information, but a lot of it is not accurate. And furthermore, I mean, the fundamental targeting policy is one where you don't have to have identified a specific individual who is regarded as Al-Qaeda or Al-Qaeda ally. In Pakistan, it's enough to see a pattern, what they call a pattern of behavior, a particular set of vehicles who travel in a particular direction, a particular time, visit a particular building which has been identified as associated with Al-Qaeda. All of these things are sufficient to call an airstrike or a drone strike And the result is that you do get an awful lot of innocent civilians killed, and a much larger number of rank-and-file Afghan Taliban or Pashtun Pakistanis who are associated with the Pakistani Taliban organization, but who are simply, you know, people who happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, essentially. So, I mean, there's some very, very serious questions about the targeting strategy that's been adopted fundamentally in Pakistan, which go to the question of whether we really want to be carrying out a war which, you know, all we're doing is killing a lot of people without fundamentally changing anything. Mm-hmm. All we're doing is making more and more Pashtun people in Pakistan very angry at the United States, and of course reinforcing the anti-Americanism in Pakistan more generally.
Yeah. Gareth, coming back to the president's speech and the troop levels in Afghanistan, I do give credit to some of the progressives in the House, led by Congresswoman Barbara Lee of Oakland, who were calling for a much more aggressive pullout, 50,000 troops this year. And also to her credit, Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi was on CNN on Sunday, and she politely but pretty firmly suggested that she wanted to see the president act faster and more aggressively. She did it trying not to give a big political opening to Republicans, but clearly the sentiment in the president's own party is very clear that he is not going far enough fast enough. Do you see any real impact from that, or is he able to brush off the progressive wing of his party?
I think he's much less able to brush off the progressive wing with each passing week and month. We see right now that there are a series of trends, a series of tendencies, which are pushing inevitably that the United States toward a faster withdrawal, even though I think at this point the president has not made up his mind about what troops he will withdraw after 2012. He's still keeping, as I said in my article, I think he's keeping the door open to leaving more troops there for a much longer period of time than the American people would want. I think that he's, his basic modus operandi is to not make any decision that he can put off, and he's waiting to see what the politics are going to look like a year from now and 2 years from now before he makes any decision. Mm-hmm. And I think that as a result of that, it's inevitable that he's going to find the pressures have built tremendously over the next year and the next 2 years, that it's going to be very, very difficult. Much more difficult than it is today for him to maintain a troop presence there. And as I have been hearing from friends in Afghanistan, it just doesn't make sense not to change your strategy once you've committed yourself to reducing the force from what is now 150,000 troops, including the NATO troops, to down to 60-some thousand troops or below. You have to change your strategy. And I think what that really means is that he is going to have to reconsider his position on negotiations with the Taliban. Right now, he's refusing to offer a timetable for withdrawal, which is the price of admission, as far as the Taliban leadership is concerned, for serious negotiations to end the war. I think he's got to offer that timetable for withdrawal. I think that's the logical thing to do. I think the pressure on him has got to build over the next few months to reconsider the negotiating strategy. That is the only thing that makes any sense.
And, Gareth, one of the other issues we see here is, a kind of duplicitous approach on the part of Gates and Petraeus and others, because they want to take advantage and manipulate the American people because we don't pay attention to history. And most Americans have no real notion of what happened in Afghanistan in the early 1990s. They really only paid attention after the Taliban popped up, and they don't really know the transition and how U.S. support continued. Even if you saw Charlie Wilson's War, you'd have a muddled sense of what that's all about.
Right, exactly.
And Robert Perry, who does a great job of helping people understand recent American history, and I'm going to link to his article at consortiumnews.com, has done a great job of replaying that time period to show in a very significant way that the U.S. didn't just pull out of Afghanistan and drop our support for the Mujahideen. We were players for quite a while, and we were not successful in preventing the Taliban government from taking hold. But the idea that we can't leave now because of the way we left and created the vacuum for the Taliban in the 1990s, it's simply untrue, but it works because Americans are ignorant.
Right, and I would just take that a step further. First of all, it's not just that the United States didn't succeed in its policy in the early 1990s. What happened there was that the United States could have worked with all the parties to the conflict at that point in trying to find a peaceful solution, a kind of coalition government that would have calmed the situation and would have avoided the most extreme elements of the Mujahideen being in position of power when the pro-Soviet government was finally overthrown. Instead, the CIA was out for blood, as one high CIA official or official who was in charge of the Afghanistan operation said when Bob Perry asked him, why don't you try to get a political settlement? He said, we just want to have Najibullah, that's the pro-Soviet leader, hang from a light post. And that's exactly, of course, what happened. But they paid the price of that lack of interest in having a political settlement because when the extremist Mujahideen took over, there was simply civil war among themselves. And that, of course, then led to the reformist, the Taliban movement, being given great legitimacy and public support, political support, for taking power. So it's, again, sort of overreaching that caused the United States to stumble in Afghanistan more than anything else. And I would also add that the big thing that I think the American public has missed about the recent history of Afghanistan is that the whole rationale for the war, which is that we have to use military force to prevent Mullah Omar, the Taliban leader, from allowing al-Qaeda to come back into Afghanistan after the war if we pull out. That sort of completely misses the reality historically that Mullah Omar was never got along with bin Laden, that Mullah Omar was opposed to bin Laden's plotting against the United States, did not want him to have anything to do with plotting against U.S. interests outside of Afghanistan, and was essentially deceived by bin Laden and was very angry at bin Laden throughout that period from 97 through 2001. They didn't get along at all.
Yeah.
And so, really, this rationale for the war is completely devoid of historical accuracy.
That's amazing. It really is. And finally, Gareth, I don't know if you had a chance to see Hamid Karzai interviewed by Fareed Zakaria on CNN on Sunday the 26th.
I didn't see that, no.
Well, it was really just more of the same, and Zakaria was pretty nice to him. Clearly, to maintain access, he can't push too hard on Karzai. But Karzai was permitted to maintain that he's getting a handle on the corruption thing and that it's better than it was. He's now more aware of the corruption in his government. Apparently, it was all happening without his knowledge before. But he wants to blame the Americans for bringing billions of dollars into his country and squandering it in ways that he and his brother have been able to skim off large amounts and take it out of the country before it even gets spent on building a road or a school or anything else. And so it was kind of bizarre to hear him
talk.
Well, of
course, you're right. I mean, you know, for Karzai to completely shift blame from his own shoulders for the corruption within his regime is certainly laughable. But on the other hand, he does have a legitimate point, which is that U.S. Economic assistance to Afghanistan clearly has had the effect of corrupting an entire society. There's just simply no way of getting around it, that this aid has, instead of contributing to nation building, it has contributed to the massive corruption in that society to a point where it is, there's no possibility of reducing it. This is a problem that cannot be reversed without simply the United States pulling out and allowing that society to return gradually sort of an Afghan basis for its economy and social structure.
Mm-hmm. The other critical part that Karzai talked about was Obama's speech, and he basically had a kind of muddled position. Zakaria said, well, gosh, you just said you wanted the occupying forces to leave. And he said, well, that was in the context of these night raids and the killing of innocent civilians. And it was a limited context. And so he's pretty much all over the map, and it's very hard to get a sense of how Karzai actually views Obama's strategy here. And, of course, he doesn't really get much of a say, does he?
Well, he doesn't. I mean, the problem with Hamid Karzai is that he's a man who really does not have real sovereignty. His government does not have real sovereignty over Afghanistan. I mean, I've had one Afghan official say to me that the problem is that Afghanistan has negative sovereignty, sovereignty that simply doesn't exist. It's the U.S. military which has the real sovereignty, in the sense that they can do whatever they please. And indeed, that's what we've seen happen in recent years, where Karzai has bitterly complained about the night raids and said they should stop. But he has no power to do anything about it. The other reality, of course, is that he clearly does need U.S. troops for years and years into the future, and he knows it. So he's not going to stand in the way of any decision to keep troops there. He is going to agree to what the United States has been asking for, which is a so-called strategic partnership agreement that would allow for semi-permanent stationing of U.S. troops well beyond 2014. However, he's going to use whatever leverage he can get to get more concessions from the United States in the process. One rumor that I've not been able to confirm is that he's going to try to get the United States to acquiesce in a third term as president. And of course, under the Constitution, he only gets two terms, but there's good reason to believe that he's not going to accept that.
He's going to pull a Bloomberg, huh?
He's going to pull a Bloomberg, indeed. And you know, the Americans, I think, would be hard-pressed to come up with any alternative to Karzai, as bad as he is. So I don't know how that's going to play out.
Well, and after that last election debacle and the U.S., trying with a straight face to say that, well, it was a process consistent with legitimacy.
Yes, that was one of the weaker, one of the weaker accolades for an election that I've ever heard.
Well, and I, rest his soul, Richard Holbrook was on the PBS NewsHour shortly before his death. Trying to argue the legitimacy of the election, and that we can't do anything about it anyway.
Yeah.
But it was bizarre.
Having to justify a policy does strange things to one's ability to tell the truth, doesn't it?
Yeah. So Gareth, I'm going to link to your article at Interpress Service, and also to Robert Perry's piece at ConsortiumNews.com. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and thanks for joining us today.
Same here. Thanks very much for having me, Peter.
Here at the Peter B. Collins Show, from time to time, I go to my mailbox, either a postal mailbox where there's a CD, or my email box where there's an audio file, an MP3 attached. And I've learned a lot from Americans who express themselves via music. And just recently, John Ringer sent me a CD with two versions of a song called My Country, My Ass. And I haven't met John except for 30 seconds before we started the conversation here. He'll join us in a moment. And I think the best way to open this up is to listen to the uncensored version of John Ringer's song, My Country, My Ass.
Now tell me again how this country is the land of the free and the home of the brave. You can't really believe that what you see now is the reason so many brave men gave. The teacher used to say we had the Bill of Rights. I think we took our rights and sent us the bill. Well, I don't know about you, my friend, but I think I've had my fill. They've been walking on me for my whole life. I think it's finally time to draw the line. You can tell old John Cougar Mellencamp he can stick his song where the sun don't shine. My country, my ass. This is not the land I learned about in class. My country, my ass. That freedom, justice stuff is all in the past. Got a checkpoint up the road ahead. Better pull out your ID. And your taxes just went up again. Gotta cough up some more money. Be careful what you're saying when you're on the phone. You never know who might be listening in. They got cameras watching everywhere you go, so they know just where you've been. You know you better think about the books you read, or your name might go on a list. Don't take too many pictures now, or they'll think you're a terrorist. They're watching you every time you turn around, and they don't like what they see. You gotta be fucking kidding me if you think this country's free. My country, my ass. This is not the land I learned about in class. My country, my ass. That freedom, justice stuff is all in the past. Well, the banks messed up, so they took money from us and gave a $1 zillion bonus. And they didn't give a damn what we had to say. I swear to God, they think they own us. But when they say bend over, you say yes, sir, and then you vote for them again. If you're the kind of people who fought our wars, tell me how do we ever win? They've been walking on us for far too long, and don't you think it's time to draw the line? Why don't you tell those jerks in Washington to stick their laws where the sun don't shine? My country, my ass. This is not the land I learned about in class. My country, my ass. That freedom, justice stuff is all in the past. Well, they say America, love it or leave it. Well, I loved it, and it left me.
All right, you heard it here first. John Ringer, My Country, My Ass. And first of all, John, you can rock.
Thank you. It kind of rocks.
It does. That's a really catchy song. When I got this last week, I put it on and listened to it a couple of times, and it really caught my attention. You're in a country rock vein. It's like a little bit like Charlie Daniels, and Charlie's done some political stuff, but he's way to the right side of the spectrum for me. Tell us a little bit about John Ringer. And what makes you an angry American, John?
Well, I was taught things in school that they may have, I don't know, it was a long time ago, and they may have been true when I was taught those things, but now they're not really true at all, and people are pretending like they still are.
But John, you know, you refer in there about be careful at the library. They're taking your pictures everywhere. They're listening in on your phone calls. Don't you feel safer?
Not particularly safer, and to me that's the lesser important thing.
Uh-huh.
The freedom is the more important thing.
Well, I fully agree with you there, and it shames me that so many Americans sit back and say, well, they can rifle my trash, they can open my mail, they can read my emails and tap my phone calls because I don't have anything to hide. And they've filled us up with fear and the boogeyman and taken away a lot of our rights, haven't they?
Well, yeah, they have done that. And my problem is with the denial. Like, the Americans can say all those things, but they still, in their mind, believe that it's a free country. And I'm trying to correct that through a popular culture music kind of thing. Because if you go around now, you know, all the patriotic songs are still Land of the Free and Home of the Brave.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's appropriate anymore.
Now, you live in the Maryland suburbs of Washington, D.C. Do you ever go to the ball game, either the Nationals or over to Camden Yard?
I haven't gone in a long time.
Yeah. You know how they now do America the Beautiful, and often they pledge allegiance? We, of course, start with the Star-Spangled Banner. Are you comfortable with those kinds of public displays of patriotism?
Well, my personal opinion, and I'm proud to say this for the first time in front of an audience, is that I don't think that anyone now should be able to sing the Star-Spangled Banner with a clear conscience.
Tell me why.
Because it's a lie. It's the last line is, oh, say, can you see, does that star-spangled banner yet wave over the land of the free and the home of the brave? And everybody should, you know, when they're at the ball game singing that song, when they're finished, they should all yell no, because it's not waving over the land of the free and home of the brave anymore.
Mm-hmm. And how do you characterize it? Because you told me before we went on the air that you're a woodworker, a craftsman. The company you've been working for many years is just about to shut down, and I want to hear more about that story. But from your perspective as a working American, what has changed for you over the last 15 or 20 years that makes you want to holler?
Well, as a working American, not much has changed. It's the intrusion on daily life that would happen to a working or non-working American. By the government, they're just telling you what to do, and it's just gotten completely out of hand. And my main problem, you know, the situation is a problem, but the fact that people are still in denial over the existence of the situation is what causes me trouble.
So let me ask, how did you respond when President Obama went on TV late on the evening of May 1st in this country to announce that Navy SEALs had killed Osama bin Laden?
My response was doubt over the truthfulness of the facts that, as he was conveying them.
And why?
Because, well, I think Osama bin Laden has been dead. And that's not really because of things that I've heard by other people. It's just what I think. And the reason I think that is, just like communism, now that, you know, communism has kind of disappeared, the Soviet Union's collapsed. So the government needs a boogeyman and needs an enemy, you know, like in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
So now that enemy is terrorism. And the personification of the terrorism, more than anything, is Osama bin Laden. And I think it served their purposes to keep him alive, whether or not he was alive or not, so that they could always, you know, trot him out when need be, or raise the specter of terrorism to get Americans to go along with what they wanted to do. So when they said he was dead, that they killed him, and especially when they, you know, there was no body. They threw the body over the side of the boat. I was like, okay, it's possible that it's true, but you know, you're just not convincing me.
How about the porn stash? Do you find that believable? I think that's a late hit and a low blow. I have no way of proving, you know, what kind of dirty pictures were there, who they belonged to, or, you know, whether the Navy SEALs brought them with them, you know, some Islamic porn. And just dropped it there. But that one, along with the shifting descriptions of the events of May 2nd, Pakistan time, really led me to say, what are, you know, which one of these versions is true and why are there multiple versions? And so, John, I have to say that I applaud your skepticism. I tend to believe that Osama bin Laden is dead because al-Qaeda has acknowledged it and replaced him. But like you, I held out possibilities that he had been killed as far back as 2002 in Tora Bora. Benazir Bhutto, who was assassinated when she was running for re-election as Prime Minister of Pakistan, she had publicly said she thought he was dead, and her sources were Pakistani intelligence. So there's a fair body of information out there, and you're more skeptical than the professionals in the media who simply reported what the government told them, reported the different versions, often without any critical thinking, and we're just supposed to assume that all of this is a neat, tidy package that we should all just buy hook, line, and sinker.
Well, everything that they say is supposed to be something we buy hook, line, and sinker.
Now, who are they? Let's try to figure that out.
Okay, well, that would be the government, you know, the president, secretary of state, anybody that has something they want to say. What's her name? Janet Napolitano. She's a good one who likes to say things that we should all believe. And that's just what they want.
And do you have a beef with the director of the Department of Homeland Security, Ms. Napolitano?
Yeah, every federal worker swears an oath to support the Constitution. And what they don't support it. And the TSA is one of the worst. They had I think they're called Viper Squads, but it stands for something. It's an acronym. But they were searching people as they exited a train in Savannah, Georgia, not as they got on the train, but as they exited. And, you can if you want to go along with the airport searches and say, well, I'm fine with that because it keeps me safe, but they're going around to buses, bus terminals, people getting off the train, and they're just searching you because they feel like it. And I think that that's pushing you. And the Indiana Supreme Court had a phrase called modern Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, and searching you the way they are is pushing modern Fourth Amendment jurisprudence way too far.
Mm-hmm. Well, John, you're making a lot of sense here. First of all, where do you get your information? If you're a working guy, do you listen to talk radio in the shop? Do you watch a lot of TV? Do you read? Because what you're talking about, and a lot of people in your position I have talked to before, and I don't come away with the same feeling.
Well, I have a view of things, political views and what people are and what the government is and what the role of people in government are, and a lot of it is just news reports, factual things that I read filtered through my worldview.
So I'm not trying to be like Katie Couric to Sarah Palin here, but name a few sources. I mean, do you read U.S. News and World Report? You go to the Drudge Report. What are your inputs?
I did see that interview, too. I don't watch TV anymore at all.
Okay.
And that's mostly because I'm too cheap to pay for cable, and that's mostly it. My TV isn't that good. I read Carl Denninger's Market Ticker every day, and it's a blog. It's a pretty big blog. He also featured the song. He likes it. Mike Shedlock, his Global Economic Analysis. And then on Facebook, I only have 140 or so friends on Facebook, but they're all putting up news about the United Nations and the Gunwalker Project and all the things that the government really doesn't want you to know about, but it's not from questionable sources. It's all from news, and it's just not reported nationally.
Mm-hmm.
And I read that, and I know what's going on because of that stuff.
Mm-hmm. You read the Washington Post or any of the local newspapers there, the Times?
No, I don't really. I don't read the newspaper either.
Uh huh.
I guess it's all from the internet.
Yeah.
I go to some bulletin boards where they post obscure stories too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what's your background, if you care to say? Are you registered with a political party, or were you formerly?
I think I'm registered libertarian.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And I vote straight libertarian, even if I'm the only person to vote for that person.
I see. Okay. And Ron Paul, does he appeal to you?
Yes, he does. There are a couple of things. You know, he's not perfect.
Yeah.
But he's the one I like.
Mm-hmm.
I supported him in 1988 when he ran, and I really didn't know that there was such a thing as a Libertarian Party, but I got some junk mail from Ron Paul in 1988,
mm-hmm.
and I've liked him since then.
I have a lot of respect for many of his positions. He challenged the official story about 9/11. He was opposed to the invasion of Iraq. He has demanded the audit of the Fed. He goes a little further than me in wanting to dismantle the Fed and end the income tax. But I guess the problem I have is his pro-life stance, which seems at odds with libertarianism.
I'm single. I don't have kids. I've never wanted kids in my entire life. And the abortion issue is not high on my radar screen.
Mm-hmm.
And if you pushed me about my my views on it, it's very difficult.
Yeah.
You know, it's one of the hardest ones because you have to define when life starts,
mm-hmm.
and when it doesn't. And if you're going to define that it starts at conception, then you get into the positions where... And people have tried this. You know, you have a woman drinking or smoking while she's pregnant, and they want to charge her with child abuse. So, I'm not saying that's right or wrong. It's just, mm-hmm. it's just a big mess, and it's a very difficult issue.
Well, I agree with you there, but would we agree that a libertarian perspective would be that the government should not intervene in the private choice made by a woman about whether to carry a baby to term?
Well, it would be, but their position is also you don't aggress on another person.
Mm-hmm.
So once the fertilized egg becomes, by definition, another person, whenever they decide that is, then I think the libertarian position would be that you can't abort that thing.
Okay. Let me ask a little more about Eastern Stair Builders. How long have you worked there, John?
26 years.
26 years. Wow. Do you have a pension?
Well, they sold the company 5 years ago to another guy, and pension was rolled over to me, so I suppose the answer to that would be yes.
Uh-huh. Okay, so it's like in a 401k or an IRA? It's,
yeah.
It's not a defined benefit?
Right.
I see. Okay, so you have something to hold on to for 26 years of service there.
Yeah.
How much notice did they give you that they're going to shut the shop down?
Well, official notice was last Monday. They said they're not going to take any more orders, and they're going to finish what they have. But, I saw it coming for, well, really, he bought the company 5 years ago, and when the former owner told me that he called me in because I'd been there for a long time and told me that they sold the company, the first words out of my mouth were, you sold the company at the top of the housing bubble. So I'm not particularly surprised. You know, they made money the first year under the new owner, and then it just went down and down and down and down and down, and you know, for the last... especially 2 or 3 months, I go, you know, we're not going to make it. I thought we might make it till next year, but it's, you know, I've planned for this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So do you have options? Do you have other offers? Will you get unemployment?
I'll get the unemployment welfare. And
Now, wait a minute. Unemployment and welfare are different.
Well, I think...
You're entitled to unemployment because you paid into that fund, John, for 26 years. That's not a gift. That's not a giveaway. That's not a bailout. That's not welfare. Come on.
You're correct, technically, but...
You want to give it to me?
You're correct. You're absolutely right. But my position is if somebody wants insurance to provide an income for when they don't have a job, they should get it from State Farm or Allstate.
I don't think they sell it.
Well, that's because the government is, you know, forces everybody to get it. The government shouldn't force people to get it, and you should have the option of getting it or not getting it. And if you lose your job, you're shit out of luck, and if you don't...
Well, John, I've worked in the radio business for over 30 years, and in the 1980s, I was concerned that the company I was working for was going to fire me.
Yeah.
So I was in London, and I stopped by the Lloyd's of London insurance underwriting building, and I went in and I said, I need disc jockey insurance. And they kind of looked at me and said, oh, I don't know who underwrites that. And I went to 14 different people there, and I explained my situation. I said, I've been working there for 6 years, and I make good money, and I have a contract, but I think eventually they're going to fire me, and I'd like some insurance. And nobody would sell it to me.
Really? Well, I hear you go around and you get a lot of people to take like 1% or 2%.
Yeah.
Until you get 100% insurance.
Well, John, if there were privately available unemployment insurance, I think your idea might be okay. But as it is, we have a government program that is contributed to by both employers and employees. And I am offended that Republicans have tried to twist the extension of unemployment benefits during this recession as some sort of a giveaway when the amounts of money are so modest. And they've been shoveling money out the door to Wall Street, to big oil. We've got the Grover Norquist faction fighting to protect the subsidies for ethanol and Archer Daniels Midland. And so it's obscene to me that they pick on the benefits that are really needed by members of the working class in this country and benefits that they are entitled to because they earned them, but they're giving money away to the very people who have broken our economy.
Well, you're right about that. I think they, rather than give money to both sets of people, they should give no money to either set of people.
And where do the poor people go? It's just Darwin time? Charles Dickens?
I don't know. See, you're getting into a big argument that I have with my friend. I think if the government would get the constraints away from earning a living, it would be easier to earn a living, and it would be easier to save money from that work, like, say, Social Security. If you got to keep all that money, you could save it. Or if you wanted to spend it on lottery tickets, you could spend it on lottery tickets, and I think the responsibility is yours.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I don't particularly agree with that, but I respect your opinion. So, John, tell me a little bit here about what you hope to accomplish, because on the sleeve to the CD, you describe your song, My Country, My Ass, as the theme song for the next American Revolution. How do you envision that? Where does this come from? Who are the parties, and how do we revolt?
Well, that's just sort of a little tagline. I wrote the song, and it came out better than I thought it would. I didn't have any plans for the song at all. It was just a hobby kind of thing. And some people liked it, and I liked it. And I go, you know, I would like this song to sweep the country and change popular culture so that we weren't going around pretending that we were still land of the free and home of the brave while all of these things are happening. So I got this crazy idea that I would send the song. Well, see, I'm not famous. I'm not barely even a musician. So the radio station is not going to play my song, even though I've gotten it on a couple radio stations. So I thought I'd send it to radio stations and get all the angry Americans to demand that the radio stations play the song, and that way it would get the message out to the popular culture, and all the people who are responsible for doing these things that we don't like would get full credit for what they're doing. They wouldn't be able to drive home and listen to God Bless the USA, where I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. They would be getting full credit for their actions, and it would just change the way people looked at things.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of reaction are you getting to the song so far, John?
Among the people who bother to comment, the response is overwhelmingly positive.
Mm-hmm.
I've gotten cussed out by two radio stations, but that happened very early on, and it hasn't happened since. It was they thought the upside. I use an upside down flag as a logo, which is a distress signal.
Right.
They thought that was disrespectful, and it was a if you don't like it, why don't you leave kind of thing. But people, you know, they really seem to like the song.
You know, I was doing talk radio in Chicago when the Love It or Leave It slogan became popular in the 1970s, and it's always offended me because I believe that all kinds of different people love this country, even people whose ideas I think are dangerous or treasonous. And what really pisses me off is when somebody is so self-righteous that they can determine that because you or I hold a position different from theirs, that therefore we don't love our country, or that we are just so angry or disgusted that we should leave. And John, talking to you and hearing your song, even though we don't have to agree on every issue, I can tell you love your country. And you did this because you want to see it get better, not because you're disgusted and ready to pack up for Cuba, Canada, or some other country that starts with C. And I just, when the love it or leave it people, and there's a whole new generation of them today, when they get on television or speak in public and start to spout all this stuff, it's what makes me angry.
I think they're just trying to make themselves look good. A lot of them, it's like, who has the biggest flag? And they'll bring out love it or leave it, and who has the most families that served in the military and all this kind of thing, and they're just trying to make themselves look good.
Mm-hmm. What's Sarah Palin do for you, John?
She makes me think. She doesn't do anything for me. As far as liking her or not liking her, she's to me, if she were to get the nomination or something like that, I think she'd lose. In fact, my standing prediction is Palin somebody against Obama, Biden, and Obama wins. But she's got too many views that I don't like. You know, she still believes government is the answer to some. She believes in like the imperial America kind of thing, I think.
Mm-hmm. What about Michelle Bachmann?
Michelle Bachmann, because of her statement that, well, first of all, she voted to continue the Patriot Act, which somebody said she voted to continue it so that she could kill it later. But then, you know, I'm not going to go along with that.
Good for you.
And she said that if we turn our backs on Israel, that there's a biblical curse that comes into play. And that lost it for me with her, that statement, that believing that we would be cursed as a nation because of our foreign policy.
Well, she says God called her to run for president.
Yeah, I saw that the other night, too. And I'm like, well, you know, she's entitled to her to say what she wants to say.
Yeah. Well, John, I've really enjoyed talking with you, and I thank you for expressing yourself, for sending me this song, for talking with me today. And you've got a website at mycountrymyass.com. What's your Facebook? Is it John Ringer? Or
I have a Facebook group called My Country, My Ass, and I just like to make sure I tell everybody, go to mycountrymyass.com. There's 600 radio station links there, and request the song on the radio.
All right. Very good, sir. Well, I wish you the best, and I hope that things turn out after you leave Eastern Stair Builders in a couple of weeks after 26 years. That can't be easy. You've got a good attitude, but still, it's got to be challenging to face the uncertainty.
I'll get through it.
Okay, John. Well, thanks again for talking with me.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Hey, do me a favor. Post a link to this podcast on your Facebook page and tell your friends you like it. And then email humblehost@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until